Welcome to Wild Utah, the podcast of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm Dave Pacheco. In this episode, we talk with SUA's Legislative Director, Jen Ujafusa, and SUA's Legal Director, Steve Block, about how the 2020 election affects SUA's work to protect Utah's wild red rock country. Needless to say, the incoming Biden administration represents a significant change in philosophy from how public lands have been managed or mismanaged over the past 4 years. From her vantage point in Washington, D.C., we'll ask Jen to foresee the immediate prospects for permanent legislative protections for these lands in the U.S. Congress and discuss the lay of the land for what Congress might do in the face of the dual global crises of climate change and loss of biodiversity. We'll ask Steve to explain where we stand in regards to reversing the dramatic rollbacks of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments and how change at the top of the Department of Interior and its Bureau of Land Management will reverse the energy domination philosophy of the last 4 years. Let's start with Jen Ujafusa. Jen is SUA's legislative director in Washington, D.C. She's primarily responsible for communications and strategy between SUA and members of Congress. Jen, welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I recently read something you wrote that I found poignant for the moment. You wrote, "Politicians come and go, but the land endures. So does our passion to defend and protect the Red Rock as a national treasure." Especially in this increasingly volatile political atmosphere our country is in, how are you feeling about the results of the recent election?
Well, I'm feeling good about it. I'm feeling optimistic that we can finally start to turn the ship around from the environmental destruction that we've seen put into place by the Trump administration. It's a big relief, and it's going to make my job in D.C. a heck of a lot easier. So I'm optimistic about the future.
Good. Well, at least for the next 2 years then, right?
Right. Or four.
So considering the Democrats' House majority is smaller than it was, and with a still unsettled majority in the Senate, what are the prospects for legislation specifically affecting Red Rock Country? Is Congress completely dysfunctional and incapable of passing bills, or is this an atmosphere for an unexpected spirit of cooperation?
Well, I think that the answer is both. Congress is really dysfunctional. This isn't just something people say and throw around. I went back and looked at this report that ProPublica issued a couple of years ago, and they looked at how often House and Senate hearings were held dealing with actual legislation, you know, doing the job of Congress to hear bills. And in the early 90s, it was common for the House to hold more than 900 of these hearings over the course of a two-year Congress. By the time we got to 2016, which is when this data was available to them, it was down to 250 hearings in the House over a two-year Congress. And so we've seen this marked decline in Congress actually legislating. They struggle to even pass their spending bills. And the average number of bills passed in a given Congress is around 3% of the bills that are introduced. So it's fair when people say Congress is dysfunctional. On the other hand, if you had asked me what were the prospects for legislation affecting the Red Rock a couple of years ago, headed into the 2018 cycle, for example, I would have said they were pretty dim. And in fact, we were able to pass the Emery County bill in 2019 under the Trump administration during this extremely hostile time to environmental issues and environmental protections. And that was sort of lightning in a bottle. It came down to staffers on the Hill that looked at things a little bit of a different way. Senator Hatch being especially motivated because he was retiring, and Emery County, the county, having something in place that they were interested in trying to push forward. And so those things are difficult to predict, but I do think that we always watch the horizon and try to look for those opportunities, even in times when they may be unexpected.
So even if Congress doesn't come up with something like Emery County bill again, there may be something affecting Utah's Red Rock that is packaged up in some bigger bill that has maybe hundreds of bills in it, that there's enough in there for everybody in Congress to get something out of it that may actually pass.
It's always a possibility. I mean, package bills are what Congress tends to do these days. It's one of the only ways they get legislation done. And we will certainly be pitching ideas to our champions of things that they could be doing to move the ball forward. And of course, we will reintroduce America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, which is our flagship legislation that proposes to protect 9.2 million acres of wilderness in Utah.
So the incoming Biden administration has been outspoken about tackling the climate crisis and embracing the scientific consensus to protect 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030. That's the 30 by 30 campaign we've heard about, in order to give humanity a fighting chance at turning back global warming and staving off the loss of biodiversity. What role do you see America's Red Rock Wilderness Act contributing to this initiative?
Well, I think it could play a big role. The Red Rock Bill is, as I said, the flagship vision for what should happen in Utah. And you really can't get to 30 by 30 without thinking big, thinking of big landscape scale protection like what we're proposing in the Red Rock Bill. Utah is right at the heart of the spine of the continent, and creating habitat connectivity and climate mitigation requires that anyone who's serious about 30 by 30 has to consider Utah a piece of the puzzle. The other thing is, protecting the lands in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act would keep a significant amount of fossil fuels in the ground, which is an important and necessary step to really tackling climate change. So we will be approaching the Biden administration with that message, and we hope it's one that they'll listen to.
So most of the lands in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act don't have any special designation, and only so many are wilderness study areas that have some form of interim protection. A large portion of the balance of these lands have been identified by the Bureau of Land Management as lands with wilderness character, and those are the lands we have to work hardest at to stay natural. What can the agency do to give these lands more protection?
Well, that's a great question, Dave. So the agency, as you say, does have these lands with wilderness character as a designation that the agency issues. But what it means is that they just have looked at places that they manage, Bureau of Land Management lands, and agreed with us that they qualify for wilderness protection. But instead of doing anything about that, they kind of just throw up their hands with these wilderness character lands and say, okay, we see that it could be wilderness, but we're not going to treat it with a special management paradigm because of that. So that can lead to decisions from the agency like issuing lease sales in these lands that they themselves say have wilderness character, or making travel management decisions that are bad ones in these sensitive landscapes. So the first thing the agency could do under a Biden administration is decide that lands with wilderness character are special and deserve extra consideration when management decisions are being made. A long time ago in the ancient history, under the Federal Lands Policy and Management Act, it used to be possible for the agency to convert these inventoried lands that they identify as having wilderness character into wilderness study areas, which are a protective designation. But there was a settlement that is non-binding between the Secretary of Interior under the George W. Bush administration and the then governor of Utah, where the BLM essentially said, hey, we're not going to use this authority we have to manage these places as WSAs anymore. We're just going to throw that in the trash. Because that settlement is non-binding, the Biden administration could undo it. And we think that that would be a really strong step forward. But even before something like that were to happen, reinstating the ability to designate new WSAs, wilderness study areas, the Biden administration can and should press pause on decisions that the Trump administration has issued in these sensitive places. So the Trump administration has issued leases for oil and gas and other things in these lands with wilderness character. It has made poor travel management decisions in these places. They even went so far as to approve a highway through the Red Cliffs National Conservation Area, which is there and was designated in the first place to protect the desert tortoise. So all of these bad decisions that aren't appropriate for the landscapes that they've been placed in can be reviewed under the Biden administration day one, and we're certainly going to encourage them to do that.
Well, let's hope they listen and reverse some of the damage that's been done over the last 4 years. So, Jen, we really appreciate you taking time today to clarify some of these things that can be done and that we can expect to see coming up, really starting in January. Cross our fingers and hope that the Biden administration does the right thing.
We certainly will, Dave. And it won't be enough for the Biden administration to just set the clock back to where we started before Trump took office. We really need to see forward progress and forward movement on the climate crisis and the nature crisis. I think our listeners should be hopeful that we will see such progress. I certainly am.
So let's bring in Steve Block, SUA's legal director. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thanks.
So, Steve, the incoming Biden administration included a plank in their campaign platform to restore both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. Talk about the interplay between a possible Biden proclamation to restore those monuments and the ongoing legal case to answer the question whether presidents can unprotect monuments created by a predecessor.
Sure. As I think most people know, the day that President Trump came to Salt Lake City to wage his unlawful attack on the Grand Staircase and Bears Ears National Monuments, SUA, along with a coalition of other conservation groups and tribes and businesses, filed suit before his plane had even left the airport. Filed suit in federal district court in Washington, D.C. to challenge those unlawful acts. Unfortunately, over the past 3 years, though the case has moved along, we don't have a decision yet from the district court about the legality of the president's actions, and specifically whether the Antiquities Act of 1906 allows a president to attack and dismantle a national monument, or whether, as we think, Congress intended the Antiquities Act to be what we refer to as a one-way ratchet, meaning it can only be used to establish or expand national monuments. And I don't expect that we're going to get a decision from the district court before President Biden is inaugurated in the middle of January. But we do expect and have been told, as you indicated, that President Biden will swiftly act to restore the national monuments. We don't know exactly what his proclamations will say, but what we're confident of is that when they're released, we will have the Grand Staircase Escalante and Bears Ears National Monuments back in at least their original form, their pre-Trump form, if not on the Bears Ears side, an expanded national monument. And that's because the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition has called for a 1.9 million acre monument. So has San Juan County, though President Obama's monument was only 1.3 million acres. So there's the potential that we could end up with an even larger national monument on the Bears Ears side.
Well, I know that a lot of our listeners and supporters of Bears Ears are hoping for that larger monument and are really paying attention to it. So we'll watch really closely right after the inauguration. Hopefully something will happen. Steve, let's turn our attention to the damage done by Trump's macho energy dominance agenda. You know, it's an understatement that people around the world are looking forward to a U.S. president who once again takes climate change seriously. Since 2017, the Trump administration has sold hundreds of leases in Utah to their buddies in the fossil fuel industry, yet SUA and its conservation partners have successfully kept the drill rigs at bay precisely because when shelling out these leases, the BLM failed to take climate into consideration. So what do you see as the lasting legacy of energy dominance on Utah's wild places?
Well, as listeners probably know, and as you just said, the Trump administration really has bent over backwards to lease as much of our wild Utah as they can before they leave office, to the tune of hundreds of leases that cover hundreds of thousands of acres. The good thing, if you will, is that since they're fundamentally climate deniers, the officials in the Trump administration haven't taken the effect of that leasing and development on climate change. And that's been a flaw, not just here in Utah, but across the West. And we're really fortunate that we're following on the footsteps of our partners and colleagues in other states who have challenged similar unlawful leasing decisions in places like Montana, Colorado, and New Mexico, and gotten favorable decisions from the courts saying that those Trump lease sales in those states were unlawful. And in fact, there was a decision from a district court judge in Washington, D.C., who even held that some of the Trump administration's lease sales in Utah were also unlawful. So we're building on those decisions to invalidate essentially all of the leases that the Trump administration sold from 2017 through the end of this year. And hopefully we'll get there. We have been helped along the way by the fact that the price of natural gas, the price of oil has stayed fairly low, which means we haven't seen a real boom in drilling like we did in the mid-2000s under the Bush administration. At that point, they were both leasing and drilling throughout the West and throughout Utah. But this time around, I think it's going to be a little easier for us to clean up the mess by rolling back the leasing decisions that really haven't had that much of an impact on the ground. And in fact, in the 4 years of the Trump administration, not a single well has been drilled in lands that are a part of America's Red Rock Wilderness Act.
So I understand that the Trump administration has gone back to the drawing board to try to paper over the fact that they didn't take climate into account initially when they sold these leases. Is what they're doing now going to make a difference? Is it going to make those leases more viable? Is the threat still there, or is this just window dressing in the last month of the administration?
Well, I hope it's going to turn out to be the latter. As I mentioned, there have been several other lawsuits in other states that have challenged Trump administration leasing decisions. In those instances where the plaintiffs prevailed, the United States and the Bureau of Land Management went back and prepared similar supplemental analyses. And just last month, a judge in Washington, D.C. held that the Bureau's supplemental analysis was still not sufficient. And that supplemental analysis is very similar to what the Bureau has tried to pass off here in Utah. So we'll have to see what they do before they leave town. I expect that the Trump administration will try and finish the leasing process for as many lands as it can before they shut the lights out or before we shove them out the door. But I feel like we're in a pretty good place to challenge those decisions and to have them set aside.
Well, thanks for tying that up for us. I think that that's a really important kind of legacy of the fight that we've been in for the last 4 years that people can look back on and say, yeah, even though the times were really tough, we were able to hold the drill rigs at bay. So, Steve, I want to turn our attention to SUA's ongoing work to encourage the Bureau of Land Management to adopt sensible off-road vehicle travel plans. During the Trump years, one terrible plan, the plan for the San Rafael Desert, was officially adopted. I understand there are 11 more plans that a Biden BLM might complete over the next 4 years. Regarding those, what areas would those affect, and how much acreage is involved? Why are they important for our ongoing work, and what is SUA doing to make sure those plans are better than the one Trump's BLM signed?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of little subparts there, so I'll try and break that up. The Bureau of Land Management is going back to revisit more than a dozen travel management plans as a part of a settlement agreement that they entered into with SUA and others in 2017. The lands at issue are most of eastern Utah, so starting up by Vernal and Dinosaur National Monument, running down to the Book Cliffs, to the lands around Labyrinth Canyon and the Dolores River, much of the Price Field office, so the San Rafael Swell, as you mentioned, San Rafael Desert, down to the Dirty Devil, and finally over to the Kanab Field office. It's about 3 million acres in total. And the Trump administration, with this first plan that they got across the finish line in the San Rafael Desert, really seemed to go out of their way to choose the worst possible option. The plan that they selected more than doubled the miles of off-road vehicle trail in the San Rafael Desert, ignored what the impacts of that kind of decision were going to be to the climate, to wildlife, to wilderness values, and we intend to challenge that plan. We hope and we'll work hard to make sure that the Biden administration makes better decisions as they take over the reins and continue work to issue new travel plans, and that their plans are more balanced. that they don't, and this isn't an issue, I think it's easy to play this off as sort of an all or nothing issue. There's still going to be thousands of miles of dirt roads and trails for families to drive on to access hiking trails and campsites, even for motor vehicle enthusiasts to drive on. But our goal is to really eliminate the most damaging trails, the trails that threaten to destroy cultural sites, that harm wildlife, that impact wilderness values, that result in the phenomenon known as dust on snow, which results in faster snow melt-off here in Utah and in western Colorado. And it's a lot of hands-on involvement. You know, we have a team of attorneys and field staff here in SUA's Salt Lake office and the Moab office who are on the ground inventorying what the routes are that BLM is looking to possibly designate for motorized use and making sure that we have even better and more in-depth information than the agency does about those. Hiring third-party experts like wildlife biologists and cultural resource specialists to spend time on the ground inventorying and looking at the resources at risk along those routes. And then we share that information with the BLM in a way that's easy for them to review and interface with it. And I'm really confident that we have much better, much more specific information about every single route that BLM is thinking about designating that implicates America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. Now, simply sharing that information with them doesn't mean they're going to make the right decision. And then that's where the advocacy part comes in, where our wildland staff and the legal staff meet with field office and district office employees and talk about and visit on the ground these routes. And I think that's how we're going to win the day, is really the work in the trenches to steer BLM to make better, more balanced, and more durable decisions.
Well, I know that myself personally, having been around SUA for over 20 years, this issue has been ongoing for a very long time. And I know that what you say is right in that we have good information, and that comes from years of field work. And that information is really valuable when it comes to the nitty-gritty details of where these routes are. And I hope that this time, sharing that information with BLM will result in some more reasonable travel plans that don't damage the landscape and don't damage all those resources. So, Steve, there's a ton of issues we could talk about here. And among the many awful things that happened under Trump was the relocation of the BLM's headquarters to Grand Junction, Colorado, and the subsequent sacking, retirement, or reassignment of agency staff with hundreds of years of experience. How do you see this ending up? Is that relocation destined to be reversed under Biden? And is this just part of a greater cultural shift towards a philosophy of higher environmental protection under Biden that's needed at BLM?
Well, I do think that the relocation of the office of the Bureau's headquarters to Grand Junction will be swiftly reversed, and the leadership is going to return to Washington, D.C. It's a bit of a myth that the Republicans have adopted that the Bureau of Land Management is a Washington, D.C.-centric organization filled with faceless bureaucrats who operate in windowless offices in Washington. And the fact of the matter is that the overwhelming majority of Bureau staff are in the western states already, but that it's important that the headquarters be in Washington, D.C., that the director and a cadre of both career and appointed staff are in Washington to interface with the secretary's office and with the White House, the Council on Environmental Quality, and with members of Congress. So I think that's going to happen fairly swiftly. There was this mass exodus, I think, of staff who didn't want to move either to Grand Junction or to some of the other western states where they were being relocated to. It's a little less clear to me what happens. I think some of those staff can be rehired if they want to come back. And there was a lot of expertise that was lost, so I think there's a sore need for some of those staff to return, even if on a temporary basis. The damage is going to be the staff who simply don't want to come back, that they don't like feeling like they're a political football. And it's hard to blame them for that. And I think it's going to take some time for the agency to recover. And when you talk to people, I think, who are the front runners to head up the Bureau or to be influential in the Bureau and the Interior Department, they're saying the right things. They're saying things that I like to hear in terms of returning the Interior Department and the Bureau of Land Management to its mission of serving the public, serving a variety of interests to the public, not simply the oil, gas, mining, livestock industries, and recognizing the importance of Native American tribes and recognizing that a broad and inclusive approach to LGBTQ is important to the American story. And I think that it's going to be a much more diverse and inclusive agency and department under the Biden administration.
Well, related to this, what about decisions made by Acting BLM Director William Perry Pendley? He's the self-described sagebrush rebel that Trump wanted as his BLM director, yet he was never confirmed by the Senate. What's his legal status, and have his decisions been challenged?
So some of the decisions signed off by Pendley or that he was involved in have already been set aside. There's a ruling from a judge in Montana in which he held that three resource management plans that Mr. Pendley was involved in were going to be set aside because Pendley was acting unlawfully as the director of BLM. How that's going to play out in the myriad of other decisions that Pendley was either directly or indirectly involved in is a little less clear. There's another case moving through the courts in Colorado. There's a case in Washington, D.C. that all focus on this somewhat arcane law called the Federal Vacancy Reform Act. And that's the law that the judge in Montana reviewed and held that Pendley was unlawfully acting as the BLM director. There are a couple of plans in Utah that crossed the finish line while Pendley was sitting as the director. And we're scrutinizing those and thinking about how to challenge them and when and where.
Well, I guess that's the price they're going to pay for cutting too many corners.
Well, we hope so.
Hey, so a lot of these things that the Trump administration did were through executive order, and many of them are likely to be reversed or turned back by the Biden administration because they don't have to go through Congress. So what about the all-encompassing changes to the biggest one of them all, the changes they made to the National Environmental Policy Act? Do you see a time coming when the public is again allowed to meaningfully participate in issues that directly affect people? And will we be getting back to processes that have helped protect the environment for the past 50 years under NEPA?
Well, I hope so. And I expect that that's going to be the case. You know, the NEPA rollback and changes were a little bit different than some of the Trump orders where he was able to act more by fiat. This was a rulemaking, so it went through a formal, lengthier process. There are, I think we're up to 5 or 6 lawsuits across the country challenging the new NEPA regulations. SUA is a party to one of those lawsuits that is moving through the courts in California. I expect in fairly short order that there will be resolution to one or more of those cases, and we will find ourselves once again able to fully and meaningfully engage in the NEPA process.
What's the timeline on that? What do you think?
Well, I hesitate to speculate on what it would be. I would imagine in the first 6 months we'll see, if not a formal resolution in one of the cases, meaning one of the plaintiffs is able to prevail on the merits of their claims, that there will be some executive action to restore some order to this situation.
Good. Well, Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today. We really appreciate your time to clarify some of these very complex issues, and hopefully we'll get back to some sort of semblance of order that we can all trust and that is good for the environment. So we really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks, Dave. It was great. I appreciate it.
Wild Utah is recorded at SUA's main office in Salt Lake City on equipment purchased through the generosity of our members. You may not realize it, but SUA is primarily member-funded. Over 90% of our revenue comes directly from individuals who care about protecting Southern Utah's Red Rock Country. We're proud of that because it keeps our voice independent. If you'd like to help protect Wild Utah today, please head to SUA.org and click the donate button. We appreciate your support. Wild Utah's theme music, What's Worth, is composed by Moab singer-songwriter Haley Noel Austin. Post-studio production and editing is by Jerry Schmidt. To stay informed about current events at SUA, Visit us at SUA.org and click on Get Involved to discover how you can join the movement to protect wild Utah. To receive information and alerts via text message, text the word Utah to 52886. That's the word Utah to the number 52886. Follow the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance on Facebook, on Instagram, at Protect Wild Utah, and on Twitter, at Southern UT Wild. And be sure to subscribe to the Wild Utah podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. Visit SUA.org/podcast for additional ways to subscribe and to access our archive of previous episodes. On behalf of SUA, I'm Dave Pacheco. Thanks for taking the time to listen. We hope you can join us for the next episode of Wild Utah.